Hello and welcome back to PaleoCast. I'm Dave Marshall and you're joining us on the penultimate episode of our coverage of the 74th Society of Vertebrate Paleontology annual meeting here in Berlin. This episode is quite a good one, even if I do say so myself. We've managed to interview no less than three of the academics with big breaking news stories, and we've got in another listener request. Unfortunately, with tomorrow being the last day, we won't be able to take any more requests, but I'll still endeavour to get some of the biggest interviews I can. I hope you're continuing to enjoy these almost live podcasts, and please remember to like and share, and we can help show people what it's like to attend a conference such as this. I'm here with Stephanie Penck and Melanie Altner, both from Munich, and both have been looking at the East African Rift Valley and the fossil fishes that you can find there. So I remember from biology class that the East African Rift Valley is really important for looking at cichlid fishes. Is that right? Have you been looking at the fossils of those?
Yeah, for sure. We're expecting a lot of cichlids because East Africa is a hotspot for cichlid diversity today.
Yeah, because the cichlids representing today's best model system for the research of adaptive speciation.
Okay, so they are a case study, as you say, for speciation. Were they really diverse in the past as well?
Up to now, the fossil record is fairly low compared to today's diversity, and mostly consists of incomplete fossils, so like isolated teeth or bones. That's why most generally fish from there are not identified down to species level, but more genus level or tribe level.
So what other kinds of fishes do you find in these localities where you've been looking?
In my Katoro site, I found cichlids of the tribe Pablo Crumini, and because there are in general four major clades of cichlids. So we have the clade of the African cichlids, the Madagascan cichlids, India cichlids, and cichlids from North and South America. And yeah, my fossil site is in Kenya, so my species or my fossils belong to the African cichlid clade.
And Melanie, have you been finding something different in your site?
Yeah, we found killifish, so the small aquarium, you know them maybe as guppies, and they are prominent aquarium fish, and we also found catfish and most likely cyprinids as well.
And so looking at your two sites, are you able to work something out about the evolution of fishes in this area? Is there anything special going on?
Fossils, for example, I compared my fossils with the other extant cichlid species. So I have found out that they belong to extant groups that today inhabiting the Congo River or rivers of Cameroon, and my fossil site is in Kenya, so I think there must be an east-west waterway within Africa.
Okay, cool. And Melanie?
Yeah. Okay, for the cichlids, it's mostly preliminary results, so I cannot say what happens next, but right now it looks like that most of my locality fish belong to fishes today living in Lake Tanganyika, so belonging to the East African radiation, which is a really exciting group. And so it's not really surprising, but I think it's a great find And for the killifish, it represents the first fossil record for the subgroup Apnoschiluidae. So it's really exciting, yeah.
And then, do you both get to go out to the East African Rift Valley on fieldwork?
Unfortunately not. So I'm at the beginning of my PhD work, so there is no, there was no possibility yet that I can come to Kenya.
Yeah, I did 3 times.
You've been 3 times?
Yeah.
And you never thought about taking Stephanie with you?
Oh, we did, but it's only on loan, so we have to bring them back after 1 or 2 years, because the Kenyans are really proud of whatever you find there, and they like to present them themselves in a museum or whatever. That's why we bring them back.
So we can make a workshop with the Kenyan people there.
That'd be cool. So you've never actually been out digging the fish?
Did.
Oh, you did.
Yeah.
And how was that? Was it
great.
Pretty hot?
Yeah, hot.
Hard work.
Everything. Hard work. Takes a lot of time, but the Kenyans going out there with us, they knew where to go directly, so we followed, and then we found everything we needed. So perfect collaboration with the Kenyan people.
All right, thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
As a pterosaur paleontologist, of course, my highlight was seeing a talk by Colin Palmer about giant pterosaurs and their flight capabilities. So we're with Colin right now. Of course, you talked about whether or not giant pterosaurs would be able to fly. Can you tell us a little bit about that talk?
Well, yeah. Well, what we were doing was trying to address a really contentious question. And in the world of pterosaurs, there's a great deal of debate about whether they could fly or not, whether they could get big, how big they got. And we wanted to apply some engineering to that to try and put some numbers to this to cut through the debate.
So your background, of course, is not in paleontology necessarily. So as an engineer and as an aerodynamic kind of side, what things were you looking at in order to answer this question?
Yeah, well, we built some models in the computer of 3 different sizes of pterosaur, 6 meters, 9 meters, and 12 meters. And we set about them, rather than you set about designing an aeroplane from scratch, and we built these in the computer. Then we calculated their aerodynamics, whether the forces involved in flying, and we also calculated the size of the structures needed for them to stay in the air, and then the actual processes when they come into land, and finally when they take off.
So could the giant pterosaurs fly?
We think there's a limit at somewhere between 10 and 11 meters wingspan. Now, some people have said they got up to 12 meters in span, but that size, we think it's that they couldn't have flown. So it seems unlikely the pterosaurs actually got that big, and most likely maxed out at 10, 11 meters.
The fossils that people say are 12 meters in wingspan, are they complete, or is would it be complete fossils that weren't flying, or are they pterosaurs that are known from not very much?
They're known from not very much. So people are making some pretty breathtaking extrapolations from a few scrappy bones to get to that size. And so I think what we're able to say there is that perhaps those extrapolations are questionable, because that projecting to 12 meters, that size animal could never have flown. So how did it make its living carrying all those wings around when it was just walking?
And what's next with this study? Do you have a further kind of area to go with this same thing? Do you have something else you want to look at?
Yeah, we'd like to refine it. I mean, it's an engineering approach, so we started a very general top level approach, and we want to increase the accuracy and fidelity of the model by maybe actually modeling the individual muscles and creating the structures rather than having a general overview.
Well, that definitely sounds interesting to me. I look forward to hearing more in the future. Thank you, Colin.
Thank you.
So one of the requested interviews we've had is for Brian Switek, and we have him right here, right now. So thanks very much for joining us, Brian.
Oh, my pleasure. You caught me while I was passing by. You know, how could I refuse?
So could you tell us all what it is you actually do?
Yeah, it's sort of an enigma because I do so many things, you know, sort of the jack of all trades, master of none sort of thing, where I'm a freelance science writer. I blog for National Geographic. I've written a couple of books, written in stone and my beloved Brontosaurus. I started a new video series on YouTube, something called Dinologue. So it kind of sounds like a coprolite, but it's like dialogue, but dino in the front. And yeah, I freelance wherever I can. And that also gives me the flexibility to go out in the field and actually, you know, dig up some fossils, do a bit of the science. You know, I volunteer with crews all throughout the West, you know, places from Ghost Ranch, New Mexico to Natural Trap Cave. So yeah, it's a fun living to, you know, write about science, but also get my hands dirty actually digging some stuff up.
So would you consider yourself to be more of a journalist or more of a scientist?
I consider myself a science writer, if anything. I mean, I can do journalism, and sometimes I do that when I write news stories for, you know, a particular outlet like National Geographic or Nature, but that's a hat that I kind of put on its peg and then go and do other things. Most of the time, I really enjoy either being involved in the science or learning about it and then communicating it. So it's just a matter of, you know, what I'm doing and what venue.
So for someone like National Geographic, say, would they come to you and say, could you write us a story about dinosaurs? Or do you go to them and say, hey, I've just been out in the field and I found this really cool story out?
Yeah, well, it kind of works both ways. So most of the time I'm pitching them, I'm trying to come up with stories, or I hear about something I'm really excited about, and I try and find the right place to put it. So, you know, like a National Geographic magazine story, it's got to have a lot of photographic potential. Like, the words are almost secondary, I hate to say it. It has to be a really good-looking story. And then, but you still have something compelling at the heart of it that fits the spirit of what the magazine is, whereas something like, you know, science news, it's just going to be like, you know, 500 words, maybe even 100 words. That's like easily digestible, and that's like a new paper coming out. So, you know, for most of that, I'm just scouring journals or, you know, just chatting with people about what's new, what's exciting, and find the right place to put it. Other times, especially with some things I'm doing now, you know, I've sort of become like the dinosaur guy in terms of writing. And so, you know, many magazines, you know, if they've got a story that's been dropped or something they need rushed, a lot of sort of difficult for low pay work, but nevertheless keeps the lights on, they come to me to write it. So I've actually got commissioned last week to do a children's book that's due a week from now, all about prehistoric predators for a group called Cider Mill Press that Julius Kitchenye is doing the artwork for, and, you know, he's a fantastic artist, so it's really, you know, a pleasure to put words to what he's already created in paleo art. So in terms of, yeah, like how I make a living doing this, it's a little bit of a mix of both.
Do you find that you're given pretty tight deadlines?
It depends on the story. I mean, and that's the thing, you have to kind of, it's almost like cooking in a way, you know. If you're making a really big meal, like, you know, for me, it's like it's making like Thanksgiving dinner, where, you know, there's the turkey and that takes all day, but in the meantime you have to make the mashed potatoes and the stuffing and the green beans and all that stuff. So stuff that's like on a short burn, stuff that has like a quick turnaround time with other things that are going to take a really long time, but that's going to be the really juicy story. So like right now I'm working on my third book. I've got a National Geographic feature story in the works, but I also do a lot of just quick hit blog stories, news articles, things like that. So it's a mix. If I only did one thing at a time, then I probably wouldn't be able to make a living doing what I do.
So I guess that you're often doing very disparate stories. Like, you've got a story about this here, a story about that there.
Yeah.
But have you got any like overarching narratives, say like with your Dinologues things that you're doing?
Most of the time, it's a matter of just, like, I'll start picking away at a particular question. Like, lately, I've really taken interest in Mesozoic mammals. And, you know, as a kid, it was always like, they're these little shrew-like insectivore things, and they're kind of boring. They're under the feet of the dinosaurs, living in the shadow of the Mesozoic. But it turns out, you know, in the last 10 years, we've got, you know, small mammals that they're flying like gliding squirrels. Mesozoic mammals are acting like beavers, like anteaters. There's this, you know, they're really a success story more than anything else. So once I start, you know, picking away at like one paper, it's like, ooh, there's something else that connects to that, something about like feeding mechanics and something else about this new taxa that's been, you know, described. So, you know, sometimes when I get on sort of a tear and one thing leads to another. But you know, I'm kind of glad you asked that because someone was asking me about this yesterday, where my whole writing program is generally connected to each other. So book projects and things like that, I'll use the blog to do the research reading I need to then do the bigger project. So it'll be like little snippets that then I can then synthesize and turn into something else. So the blog is really like the writing laboratory that helps me get ideas to then go and do all that other work.
So what do you think about science communication in paleontology as a whole? Do you think that we are given a good enough representation in the general media, or is there more that scientists can be doing to get the true face of paleontology out to the public?
Yeah, I mean, we could really use a greater diversity of voices. I mean, in terms of freelancing, I'm the only full-time paleo writer there is, really, like, working the way that I do. And there are plenty of scientists, you know, people like you who are doing podcasts and doing video casts and doing really interesting things. And there are other journalists who often cover paleontology, but it's also mixed in with a lot of different stuff. But there are often, there's some people that I know who are focused, like, solely on paleoanthropology. And it's good to have expertise in those fields, but, you know, because of that, because, like, so many of us, we have our specialties within paleontology, within the natural sciences, the more voices we can get out there, the better. And that's a wonderful thing about, you know, blogs and Twitter and YouTube and paleocasts and you know, all the things that people are doing now. It's not quite a meritocracy because people need to know that you're there. But at the same time, if you're passionate about it and you love what you're doing, you can, you know, carve out a little niche for yourself that didn't exist before. And even in terms of who a paleontologist is, I think that's a really important thing, especially early career scientists, people from basically anyone who's not like a 50 plus white guy. I would really like to see do science communication, because often when you watch, you know, documentaries on the Discovery Channel or wherever else, it's the same 5 or 10 people, and they're all really good scientists, but at the same time, it gives this impression that paleontology is just like almost any other science, you can name it. It's some old, bearded, white-haired, white dude who, you know, has a deep voice and, you know, maybe a cowboy hat, and that's what a paleontologist is. And that like, just, we're sitting here at SVP and I'm looking around the room, and that does not represent the diversity at all that I'm seeing. So in terms of paleontology in itself and science in general, the more people we can get out there, the more voices we have, the better it will be, especially because there's so much science to discuss. Like, I can't do it all. Even all the people who do this regularly, we don't even, you know, pardon the pun, scratch the surface on everything that's being published or interesting in the field. And part of it's a pipeline issue. You know, part of it, we can produce so much, but, you know, the magazines or other outlets have to be willing to take it. You know, sometimes I run into that problem where paleontology is almost viewed as a whole, where someone will say, well, we don't want a story about trilobites because last month we just did something about dinosaurs. And that's, it's like, they're totally different things, totally different organisms, totally different story ideas even. You don't hear that about genetics in a way. You don't see like a magazine like Nature going like, well, we did a story about genetics, you know, 2 months ago. We don't want another one. Paleontology, I think, suffers from that a little bit. It's viewed almost as this, you know, kid stuff kind of thing where everything's the same. But the more people we have kind of, you know, knocking on the door, the better able we'll be to overcome that.
Okay, and where are people to find your blog?
Yeah.
All of your outlets.
Yes, to run off the long list of things. Well, the best thing you do if you're on Twitter, follow me at Laelaps. So that's LAELAPS. Most everything that I write, I post on there. You can also go to www.briansweetech.com. I regularly update that with what I've written lately. The blog is also called Laelaps. It's on National Geographic. It's pretty easy to find. And on YouTube, look for Dinolog. So, like the word dialogue, but dino in the front. And one way or another, you find one, I think everything is kind of linked together. So any of those places, you can keep up with what I'm up to.
All right, thanks very much, Brian.
Oh, it's been a pleasure, thanks.
One of the most interesting talks given at SVP so far was by Marco Mazzola of the Nova University of Lisbon and Museo de Lourinhã. And he's been looking at some trace fossils from inside a diamond mine, is that right?
Yes, it is.
What was the series of events that led you to find, to be looking at these fossils with inside a diamond mine?
So it all happened because of the Russian geologist called Vladimir Perovov, and he's a geologist, he works for the Katoka Mine Company. And in December 2010, he found these tracks inside the mine. And he just decided to take some pictures, you know, and to send these pictures to the Portuguese Palingola member, Otavio Mateus. And Otavio immediately recognized these tracks belonging to some vertebrates. And so the diamond mine of Katoka was contacted immediately in order to possibly preserve these tracks for Otavio to go there back in the later summer and to try to collect these tracks.
So it sounds like a really difficult study to do. Basically, if you're in a diamond mine and they're stopping
digging so that you can look at footprints, aren't they going to lose millions of
dollars? That's right. And that was the biggest issues at the very beginning. But we have to say that Kataka Mine Company was really nice, really respectful, and really understanding the importance of these tracks, not only for themselves, not only for our project, but for the entire nation of Angola, because those tracks, they are very important, and they belong to Angola and to its paleontological heritage.
And then another thing I don't understand is that when diamonds are formed, they're formed in things called kimberlite pipes, and they're really high pressure, really high temperature geological formation. So how did you manage to get fossil material preserved in any way, shape or form? Shouldn't it have just been completely destroyed?
Yeah, so this is a pretty interesting fact. As you said, Kataka Mine is made of kimberlite, which is a volcanic rock. And the fact, of course, you cannot have vertebrate tracks on volcanic rocks, you need sedimentary rocks. And what actually happened there is that the kimberlite pipe that made this this mine, at a certain moment it collapsed. And the collapsing made left a crater. And inside this crater, during the early Cretaceous, formed a shallow, like a stream environment. And in this environment, we had this animal walking, possibly living there, or just going there because you had fresh water around. And there is where they left this track. So we do have this small sedimentary basin over there, which is characterized by mud cracks, ripple marks, and vertebrate tracks, which is found inside the crater of the kimberlite pipe.
Okay, so the kimberlite pipe was there first, it collapsed. Would the diamonds have been there?
Yes, exactly, they were already
right there. Okay, and then you had a lake, and that's in which you got all of these trace fossils.
Exactly.
So what kind of trackways do you have?
So trackways, we have at least three distinct trackways. One belongs to a crocodilomorph, which is an animal closely related to modern crocodile. And we have two more trackways that are clearly dinosaurian tracks. They are trackways. They are made by these tracks, which have this very characteristic dinosaur morphology. And one, we are pretty sure it belongs to a sauropod, so a very big dinosaur. The other one is smaller, and it has it's weakly preserved. And because of the morphology of the tracks that make it, we can say it belongs to a dinosaur. We cannot be sure about which kind of dinosaur it belonged to, probably a small sauropod or a stegosaur.
Okay, so do these trackways have any interactions with each other?
No, not really, because the tracks from Kataka were found from different localities.
Right.
And it was like each locality bears different kind of tracks.
Okay, so there's no evidence that they were all in like the same place at the same time.
Yeah, well, they were pretty close to one to another, but they were not found on the same slab.
Right. Okay. I'm with you. So, is there anything new that you can work out based on these trace fossils about the animals that made them?
Well, we cannot go down to the animal, to the species of the animal that made these tracks from tracks. It never happens. Ichnology, it's a very complicated science, and in ichnology we don't use species names for tracks. We use names for tracks only, in the meaning you can have a beautifully preserved track and cannot say that track belongs to that animal, but you can say this track has a morphology that resembles that animal's foot or hand, whatever.
So an ichno species.
Exactly. That's what we use in ecology. We don't use taxonomy, we use parataxonomy.
Right.
So the closest we can go to the track maker is saying that it was a very big mammalomorph, but we cannot go any closer to the genus or species level.
Okay, and then is there anything that changed with the ichno species, or did it just fit neatly within an existing ichno species that we already knew about?
No, we don't. We don't have, from the worldwide fossil record of the early Cretaceous, we don't know any mammal so big in size as the trek maker from Katoka. And this is remarkable because at that time, the most of mammals that we know, well, first of all, they are described by very poor material, mostly from teeth or ear bones. And more likely all of them, they are in a mouse to a squirrel size animal. The track maker from Katoka is pretty big. It's in a size of a modern raccoon, and so far we don't know any skeletal material that can be compared in size to our track maker.
So all we've got is this unknown mammal.
Yeah, it's like we have these tracks, so we know there was such a big mammal going around somewhere. We just have the tracks of it. We don't have its body yet.
So can you work out things like its weight? You've said that it's raccoon sized.
Yes. Well, we can estimate the body size of the animal. Then about the weight, yeah, we can go. We can give a range. We cannot pinpoint. We cannot spot like one single value. We can just give a range of the size of the animal. Yeah.
But it's still pretty cool that you're able to start building a picture of this animal up, even though you've got absolutely no physical remains.
Yeah. Well, we got tracks.
Yeah. So are there any associated fossils in this locality? You say that you don't have any of the actual vertebrate material, but have you got any leaves or things like that?
No, so far we just got the tracks.
Just the tracks,
yes.
No other fossils?
No.
Oh, wow. So are you hopeful that you'll find any of this vertebrate material? Any of the bones?
Well, the sedimentary basin where these tracks were preserved is pretty small. Is not very big. We have Vladimir who's still working there and goes checking every now and then about some more fossils, some more tracks, some bones even possible. We don't know. We are just waiting. We just hope to be lucky. We've been already lucky enough finding these beautiful tracks, and if anything else comes, it's great. It will be really great.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
So with me now, I have the Dodo research team, who you should hopefully remember from episode 27, Mara Songe with Hannah Kamaya. And I'm also joined by Leon Klassens. So guys, could you tell us what the latest is with the Dodo?
Well, there's lots of exciting new stuff about dodos. And one of the big things that we're presenting here at the SVP meeting is a dodo skeleton, which represents a single individual. And it's absolutely complete. We even have kneecaps, we have little sesamoids from the ankle, tiny bones from the ankle. And this specimen, apart from being astounding, really is a beautiful gateway into the paleobiology of the dodo.
So I remember from episode 27 that you mostly just get isolated feet, isn't that right? So is this really like one of the first complete skeletons you've got?
Absolutely, and so this skeleton does not come out of the Mara Songe. When you listen to the previous episode, you notice that the swamp, it's in many ways, it's a jumble of bones. Most of those bones are leg bones. The skeleton that we have here comes out of a cave or cave-like location in Mauritius. It's both new and old, I think you can say, in that we're describing it for the first time now, but its discovery was more than a century ago. It was discovered by an amateur naturalist, a barber actually, on Mauritius, who liked natural history so much he would go out in his spare time, and he found this complete skeleton. He kind of found it a few decades after dodoas and dodo science was hot. He found it just after Richard Owen had died, who wrote the big monograph in 1866. We presented this reconstruction of dodo anatomy based on Mara Songe material. And so this amateur collector, he wrote to scientists around the world. He wrote to Alfred Newton in Cambridge, and people were kind of done with dodo, so they weren't really receiving him with open arms. And Newton was old, the collector was old, so before you knew it, you're one or two decades later, nothing has happened scientifically with this dodo, and it's been standing in the public gallery at the Natural History Museum in Mauritius as this beautiful specimen, but I think without scientists realizing that, one, we do not have complete dodo skeletons, single individual dodo skeletons, and so it's a forgotten dodo rediscovered.
So when did you make the rediscovery? When did you walk through the museum and go, hang on, isn't that a complete dodo skeleton?
So it's mostly talking to Hanukkah, who's in the previous podcast, right? Let's plug the other podcast here. If you talking to Hanukkah over the years, I think it's kind of been known through the grapevine with dodologist, well, hey, you know, there's a complete skeleton supposedly in Port Louis. Nobody looked at it. So if you think about my involvement with the project, because I was not part of this Mauritian, Dutch Mauritian team reworking the Mauro Sanche, I like functional morphology. And so I thought it would be really neat to study dodos. I thought, you know, dodos are really a beautiful, well-constrained evolutionary experiment that nature's done for me. I, as a paleontologist, have to dig up my experiments, right? They've been done already and I just need to find them. And with Mauritius being a volcanic island, about 8 million years old, you know that about 8 million years ago, it appeared essentially out of the ocean as a barren island. So sometime in those 8 million years, the flying ancestors of dodos must have arrived at this island. And because they were flying pigeons, means they cannot have been massive. So I have a maximum of 8 million years for a pigeon to arrive on Mauritius and then dramatically increase body size, right? 4 to maybe 8-fold the body size of the largest pigeons alive today, like crown pigeons. And how do you do that? How does that happen? You cannot strap 4 times or 8 times my body weight on me and expect me to walk down the street, right? My skeleton will not go for it. My muscles will not be able to carry the load. So how do you do that when it happens rapidly evolutionarily? That was my question, right? I thought a great question is a great question. And so knowing then from Hanukkah that supposedly there's this enigmatic complete dodo skeleton, I thought, well, maybe I should get, you know, associated with these fine people from the dodo research program and go out there with my 3D scanning equipment, scan what is a prime specimen, because I know the upper leg belongs to the lower leg, so I know that the relative proportions and the muscles and the tendons and the moment arms, I know they're all going to be from a single individual that must have functioned, right? I mean, it was an adult dodo. We know that it grew up and it functioned just fine in its environment. And so we went there, the specimen's absolutely exceptional. And the more we looked into dodo anatomy, the more we realized that we had bones that just simply had never been described before. We had bones that were unknown to science. Kneecaps, ankle bones that we talked about, wrist bones. And then we decided, well, you know what? We actually have to take a full step back. Because if you want to look at dodo anatomy description, you have to go back all the way to Richard Owen and his big monograph. And there have been some papers since, but really not an extensive description. And here we have this complete skeleton, single individual. Don't we have to properly describe this first, rather than syncing description of a kneecap in a locomotion paper and all these other things, right? Describing this skeleton, which we have in 3D, right? Which we can share in 3D, provides a baseline, right? The atlas of dodo anatomy.
So basically describing an animal from scratch again, like, how long is this going to take you?
So it's taken a decent amount of time. In 2011, the summer of 2011, I traveled with some students to Mauritius, hooked up with the fine people from the Dodo Research Program. I think I'm a member now. I think they like me. I hope they like me. And we scanned that skeleton. Took about 2 to 3 weeks to scan it in total. It was a laser surface scan. The skeleton is fragile. It's been strung together with metal. You can't put it in a CT scanner. It's too fragile. The metal in there, right? It won't work. So we did a laser surface scan. But then at the end of those 3 weeks, you have a laser surface scan, which is essentially a static three-dimensional object, right? All the joints are frozen in this digital model. So then comes nearly a year of work in carefully piecing apart each individual bone, doing reconstructions on where you have some of the joint surfaces that the scan could not be taken, right? It's a surface scan after all. And then building this into a mobile model, if you will, right? Where every bone can be moved individually. Then the next step in that process was to then rearrange these bones, right? The bones in the skeleton in the Mauritius, when we scan them, they are positioned the way that they were placed together over a century ago by the skilled preparator that did it. And then more than 100 years of gravity might have moved some of these bones around to different places too. So once we had the entire skeleton pieced apart, we essentially reconstructed, based on the anatomical information, reconstructed this dodo the way we think it should be put together properly. And that brings us to now, and so now this atlas is coming. And we are very fortunate, the Society of Vertebrate Paleontology selected this for next year's memoir. So as we are rushing toward deadlines, because this is a massive undertaking that sometimes I think you have to be foolish to start a process like this, but there is a deadline. We are working hard toward that deadline, and that should mean that by the end of 2015, this book comes out. That is this beautiful, I want to call it picture book, of course, because that sounds somewhat not very rigorous, but it's a relatively short description with every bone from every angle. And then because it's in three dimensions, you then have the capacity to start sharing even the three-dimensional anatomy digitally with people along the world, right? That, of course, once that atlas is done, gives us chance to get back full force in other questions we have, to really delve in locomotion, what we started out to do, but which kind of got sidelined because we had to take that step back and do dodo anatomy proper. It allows us to get into feeding. It allows us to basically get in as many paleobiological questions as you can think of that musculoskeletal anatomy might provide you some insight in. And that's a fantastic starting point for rethinking, right? Rethinking dodo biology. What did the dodo do? How did it live in its environment? Because obviously it hung around the Mauritius for so long, right? Dodos are not clumsy losers. Dodos are fantastically well-adapted large island birds that lived in a beautiful tropical, but climatically not necessarily the easiest place.
And so have there been any surprises so far with this new skeleton? Have you learned anything new, or are there any new inferences you can make? Or are you allowed to talk about that at this stage?
Yes, I'm willing to talk about some of it. And now, of course, we know that we're getting into the realm of speculation of scientists who have done something and then are going to make wild inferences. So once we take that disclaimer into mind, I mean, I can tell you some of the things that we found surprising, right? And one of them is that when you look at those hind limbs, it does in many ways look like a scaled up pigeon. Right? So I do not, at this moment, apart from increase in size and robusticity, see wildly unimagined anatomy. Of course, that does not necessarily mean that it's boring, because to me it might almost be more surprising how you can keep your anatomy the same, right? Or somewhat similar. Of course, time and more detailed study has to bear out whether what I'm saying now, you know, genuinely holds true. Other things which are really neat have to do with the anatomy of the wings. Dodos don't fly anymore, they have large body size, the wing is reduced. But surprisingly, when you look at the muscle attachments, right, those are actually large and prominent. They are not, in a broad sense, reduced, right, compared to modern pigeon wings. If the wing genuinely was in complete disuse, I would not expect robust, right, sizable muscle attachments on that wing. So that gives us ideas of, okay, the dodo wasn't using its wing for something. And then I can get all the way out there with speculation and say, well, if you look at large tropical pigeons, like crowned pigeons, for instance, that are quite closely related to dodos, then males have this display behavior where they flap the wings rigorously, I think, around mating season is what I'm led to understand. Love to see it in real life. Maybe was a dodo doing something similar like that, right? Did that wing have function in display? Now, that's wild speculation, so please take this with a grain of salt. But it's, they're intriguing directions that your brain starts to wonder in as you start to look at and ponder the anatomy that you have in front of you.
Well, I guess we'll catch up with you next year and see what you found out.
That'd be great. And hopefully, yes, I mean, hopefully grand new things are to come. And yeah, it's an exciting time for dodo research.
Okay, thank you very much, guys.
PaleoCast was brought to you by Dave Marshall with Joe Keating, Laura Soule and Liz Martin. It was made possible by funding from the Paleontological Society and the Paleontological Association, with music supplied by the Ocean Collective. Please visit paleocast.com for the supplementary material for this episode and for our archive of past programmes. Subscribe to our Twitter feed at PaleoCast and like us at facebook.com/paleocast to get all the latest news.